Cheaters and Prosperity. There are times, and I know this sounds like what a real preacher would be talking about, so I apologize in advance, but there are times when you look around and you think that we as a society have just lost our way. We've slip-slud away from ideas and ideals of personal responsibility and seem to be headed towards what is called in business outcome-directed results. That is, we are focused on what it is that we want and not how we get it or get there or what we do in the pursuit of those things that we want. Cheaters never prosper. Oh, Lord, how could I even say that with a straight face to my children or grandchildren? How could I just convey what is not simply counterintuitive, but goes against what we actually see going on in our society, where often cheaters really do prosper and really seem to be doing really well, and only a very few get caught, and so, you know, it just could be worth the risk because it doesn't bother me to cheat. We've answered, or we are in the process of answering, the age-old philosophical question. If a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? We are deciding as a society that it doesn't make a sound. There is only a sin, sorry about that word, only a transgression, only a violation. It's only cheating if you get caught. There's got to be someone there to hear it, to see it, to register it, because if you get away with it, it wasn't a sin, it wasn't a transgression, and the terrible chances are that you might really sleep well at night, dreaming sweet dreams because you got away with something. There was an old ideal, I don't know that it was ever really practiced, of sportsmanship, but I don't know what that means anymore. And I think that this is where you start looking at how we, in the words of Dizzy Dean, have slip-slud away, maybe not from our practice, but from our ideals. What I'm really talking about today is there's been a change in our ideals. There's been a change on how we see the source of our meaning and the source of conscience and the source of how we think about ourselves and the nature of the world that we live in. Cheaters never prosper. Now look, the issue of steroids probably didn't belong in the State of the Union message, but it is a real issue. It's a real issue not so much because steroids are bad for athletes. Athletes do lots of things that are bad for them, including steroids. I won't do the list, but steroids are probably among the least damaging. But the point is, it's cheating, and it's cheating in order to succeed. And you can say you're doing it for the team, or for the glory of the city, or for the Olympics, but it's really cheating. And the people who do it know it, but it's only a sin if they get caught. Not if they get accused, but if they get caught. You cannot look at Barry Bonds' body from 10 years ago and see the 40 pounds of not middle-aged normal spread, but of young middle-aged upper body spread, and not know that there's better living through chemistry going on here. And it's cheating. It's not a question of it's a good decision or a bad decision in terms of what the relationship of athletes should be to steroids or to all kinds of crazy things, but it's cheating. And it's okay if he hasn't been caught. It's cheating, some of you may go and watch one of the playoff games today and someone dives for a ball and knows that it bounced but is going to pretend that he caught it and hope that he gets away with it. Others will hold and hope to get away with it. It is, if somebody dove for a ball and the referee said, catch, and the guy said, no, it hit the ground, we'd faint dead away. Because in the culture, oxymoron, the culture of football, you don't correct the ref if he errs on your side. In the culture of golf, it's completely different. In Vero Beach, they know something about golf. There were something like 30 golf courses within 20 minutes of the Vero Beach congregation, if I remember correctly, having visited all of them at one time or another. And if you cheat at golf, there are two things that happen. One is you're not supposed to cheat, but if you do, if it's even a mistake, an innocent mistake where you groomed the fairway or the green wrong, the greater sin, the greater transgression is not reporting it. It is a culture of absolute notification. You are supposed to turn yourself in, and if you don't, that's worse than the infraction. And it's self-policing. Most of our life and most of our world, increasingly in this country and in the world at large, is becoming a question of, if you don't get caught, there is no sound. Where many of us, and we model these things to our children. We model these things when we say, look, I know you're not supposed to start school and your birthday is just a month too late, but we're going to change the date. Or we can get you into a better school and it's really a silly bureaucratic thing, but I'm going to model to you that if I think the outcome is good enough, it's okay to lie about it. And what is it that our children learn? The same thing that they learn when you go to the movies and you just kind of fudge the age a little bit. Of course, I had very mixed feelings when I no longer was tempted to fudge the age for the senior discount. I had learned long ago that they offered you the senior discount if you were 10 years older than the person selling the tickets, because they can't tell the difference between 35 and 65. And I can no longer tell the difference between 45 and 65, so this is the Doris Day glasses and lenses. But I was no longer tempted even to do the discount and to fudge it. You know, they're all little things. They're just like little snowflakes that eventually break the bow. They're little erosions of integrity that we talk about to ourselves, that we model to our children, and the children get the message. If it seems to be a good outcome, it's not really so bad. Well, I'm not sure of that. I think where most of society meets this is in areas of politics and business and taxation. Where most of us meet it, probably in areas of insurance. When you have an automobile accident and no one reports being hurt, the insurance companies are shocked and stunned. And actually, one insurance company, I had been rear-ended, and I said, I'm not hurt, and there's no real damage. They made me sign more releases than if I had made a claim, because they were just sure something was going to be revealed later. They expect, it's a mutual expectation, they expect people to lie. Cops joke when there's a break-in. No one ever had a throwaway camera sitting around. It's always a single-lens reflex, now digital, and probably Leica. And all of the stereos are state-of-the-art. And you have the expectation that people are going to inflate their losses. And then you have compensatory systems to deal with that. I had a call the other day. This is true and factual. It was a call, and it was the other day. And here's how the conversation went. I just had the diamond appraised It appraises for $27,000 for insurance purposes, and it's worth $9,000. Everybody was involved in making that happen. Everyone was involved. Consumers, people who bought insurance, were involved because they had reported things stolen, and the insurance companies weren't paying. They were paying a percentage of the appraised value. So what happens? The appraisals go up so that the compromise comes down to something that is quasi-legitimate. We see it in medical billing. We see it in all kinds of ways, that we develop these compensatory systems where we lie on one end because we assume the other people are going to cheat on the other end, and we hope that the accommodation comes down to something that more or less fits justice and reality. This is nuts. This is nuts as a way to conduct ourselves. It's nuts as an expectation. If I can do another golf analogy, when I was playing golf at Vero Beach and had a lot of trouble keeping my head down, I had a terrible slice. I would aim at the hole and the ball would go over there. So eventually I started aiming over there in order to compensate for my slice. Well, of course, whenever I did that, if there were glass in that direction, I would hit the ball absolutely straight. But these kinds of accommodation to aberration are self-reinforcing errors of heart, of soul, of judgment, and they lead us in destructive directions. And I don't know how you begin to stop this. It's so clear in areas of politics. Most people think that most politicians are crooks. I don't think that most politicians are crooks, but I think that we have a system that is completely irrational that works towards the corruption, both of the giver and of the recipient. When Congress people are running every 2 years and have to spend 3 days a week raising money, when senators have to raise $35,000 minimum a week in order to fund their next campaign, we cannot help but wonder if they are selling themselves or renting themselves up to an accumulation of the highest bidders. Their good faith response that, well, it doesn't buy my vote. Can you say rent? It doesn't buy my vote. It only buys access. I'll answer their phone calls and respond to their letters and take them out to lunch and go duck hunting with them and, oh, yeah. How can you not believe that this kind of system itself fosters cynicism, which is a cancer of the body politic, and it leads to the cynicism of the voters, the cynicism of the elected, and the apathy of the voters who become disenchanted with the system because they don't have the money to play. We have an integrity problem in our society. And in some ways, the systems that are in place to try to deal with that are also, if politics and insurance and the big one, of course, is taxation. You know, do you report everything? I'm not asking you. Just examine your souls during the collection and everything that you haven't reported, put in the basket so I can retire. But it's okay because the government is big and they've misused the money anyway, because the insurance companies are big and they're really not in the business of paying claims. They're in the business of collecting premiums. We can all be part of the cynicism, but it has an effect on all of us and on how we spend our days together and our lives together. Cynicism is not healthy. When we look at culturally, at cultural anthropology, you see that there are basically two kinds of systems, none of which is exclusively one or the other, but they're all a combination. And the two kinds are shame cultures and guilt cultures. most of Western society has been a guilt culture. A guilt culture means that if I take this purse, and it does go with my outfit today, so it's odd, so I might be tempted to, I feel terrible. I wake up in the middle of the night because I know intrinsically what I did was wrong, and it troubles my sleep. That's in a guilt culture. And many of us spent many years in the 60s. It does go nicely. Yeah, thank you. And many of us spent time in the 60s and 70s saying, guilt is bad. Guilt is a hang-up. We were also the same people who were saying sin is bad and sin is a hang-up. What did that leave us with which to balance our impulses? If I can take this and sleep well, I've got a problem. Well, the other way that society deals with this are there are shame cultures, which is, I can steal the purse. Not yet, Toots. I can steal the purse. Haven't gone through it yet. But, no, I was, you know, yeah, the ultimate horror story. Yeah, oh, yeah. My God, that diamond's here. I can steal the purse and sleep well, but what haunts me is not that I did wrong, but that I might be found out. That is a shame culture. And if I am found out, it brings shame to me, it brings shame to my family, to my congregation, to my tribe, to my nation. And we have identification. So shame cultures are not immoral. They are a different morality. And good behavior is predicated on the fear of not being found out. The downside of this, of course, is that the tree falls in the forest, and if no one's there to see it or hear it, it didn't make a sound. If I steal it and I am not ever caught, I didn't commit a sin. If I cheated on my exams and I wasn't caught, I got the grade. If I cheated on my expense accounts and nobody ever audited it, I got away with it. It's only in being found out that the sin becomes a sin. This is why you see FBI agents arresting white-collar criminals who are not in any condition to run and flee and fight, but they're handcuffing them and doing the perp walk. The point is that since guilt no longer operates in so many spheres of our daily life, we are shifting towards a culture of shame. But of course, the problem is, what happens when we have a culture that is essentially shameless? What happens when we have neither guilt nor shame, because as a society, we can't tell the difference between fame and infamy? Look at reality television and how people are willing to be humiliated for their 15 minutes of they think fame, but truly infamy. Look at talk shows and the people who come in with their problems and want to expose them for all the world. Well, you know, this is one of those sermons where you can go home and have the old kind of Woodrow Wilson line, no, I'm sorry, the Calvin Coolidge line, where wife comes home and says, he comes home. What did the preacher say? He talked about sin. What did he say about it? He was against it. Well, at heart, what I'm saying to all of us is that we have a society that is caught between a lack of guilt and utter shamelessness. And we need to find some ways of holding ourselves accountable. And guilt isn't a hang-up, and shame isn't to be shunned, but there ought to be something that lets the just sleep better than the unjust. Now, there's nothing we can do with sociopaths, but for most of us who are simply normal neurotics, I think that encouraging a sense of the connectedness, of the ramifications that our acts and our modeling have to our family and to our society, it's important that we understand that we are in this together. And we are not in the business, as so many politicians are in, of Scheherazade. It's called spinning, of coming up with the best and most elegant story that is almost completely disingenuous in terms of its substance. But communication, if we are going to know each other as human beings, words have to mean something. If we are going to form families and societies and bonds, what we say has to be understandable and true in the understanding of normal language, not the esoteric language of, well, I never said that the five planes were going to fly into the towers. I just said planes were going to. Didn't use the number five. So you tell half-truths, and those half-truths just eat away at the credibility of the body politic until we are left with very little. Now, the problem with everything that I'm telling you is that absolutist systems don't work either. I can't get up and say, never tell a lie. Never lie by omission. I lied by omission at least 3 times yesterday, and I would do it again because I had confidential information that I was asked about, and saying no comment would in fact have been a comment. So I had to balance priorities. I have a test. It's not an infallible test, but the test is this. If a social lie it will advance your position, you probably shouldn't say it. If it's to protect somebody else, err on the side of their privacy. And I can't get better than that. That's what I try to do, but it's not perfect. We are all left with a certain sense of our own discretion and our own responsibility in talking to each other, in trying to create a society where words like truth are not absolute in their relativism. And we can get to know each other as real and flawed and occasionally failing human beings, but at least have the knowledge that what we have and what we say is, as best we can make it, tempered by kindness, both true and real. And I think that those are the preconditions, truth and reality, that give us the possibility of creating and making and sustaining love, which is, after all, the doctrine of this church.